historic sites in Maine. When is the last time you visited an historic site in Maine? Was it the last time you had out-of-town guests? Or is there a place that you return to again and again for edification and reflection? There are many historic places in Maine, some well-known, such as Fort Knox, but others less famous, such as the St. Croix Island International Historic Site. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will talk about some of these places and what makes them meaningful in modern times. We'll also discuss what makes a place worth saving and opening to the public. What historic places have you visited that you found interesting? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Maine's history is rich, from our maritime heritage to all the artists and writers who have lived here. We'll learn about ways to learn about our history by visiting the many sites and attractions across the state, and why preserving these historic places matters. In the studio with me, Ellen Dyer. She is an independent museum consultant and former director of the Knox Museum and Historic Site. Bernard Fishman is museum director of the Maine State Museum. And Earl Shettleworth is state historian and former long-term director of the Maine Historic Preservation Commission. As always, we want to hear from you. Is there an interesting historic site that you have visited and that you would like to share with the rest of us? Are you looking for ideas of historic places to see? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. Ellen, why do people like historic sites? What is it? What do you think?
It's a fabulous, fabulous way to connect with your local community, I believe. I grew up in small town Maine. I developed an affinity very early on. I can remember clearly the day I found a trunk down in my parents' basement that showed the history of my grandparents' dairy farm. And the fact that I could still go and see that dairy farm and kind of see the impact that they had had on Sydney was kind of a revelation to me. And it wasn't until I made it to college that I realized that meant I should be a history major. But yeah, I just feel like it really grounds you and connects you to where you live and encourages you to invest in where you are and to be nice to your neighbor.
Okay. Well, Bernard, let me ask you, what makes something an historic site not only worth preserving, because there are a lot of buildings that are preserved but are private, but worth preserving and then worth being open to the public?
Well, that's a very complex, interesting question that people have been thinking about actually for thousands of years, because there were historic sites that the ancient Romans and even the Egyptians created for people to see. But that changes enormously, and we're in a time, as everyone knows, where the very meaning of history is being reexamined. You'll remember the recent controversy about Confederate statues and Confederate historic sites. So that does change. It often has to do with the community, and I was delighted to hear from Ellen that history makes you nicer, and I think that's an interesting point to discuss. But those things change. When I was young and you learned in school history in a different and perhaps more organized way than you do now, there were certain figures that stood forth as models of civic and other behavior. You wanted to see their sites. Now there's much more interest really in seeing how ordinary people lived and the way that life is lived. But it is all a connection with the broader humanity, an opportunity to taste life as it was lived before, a very civilizing kind of experience when approached well. So it's a good thing. I agree with Ellen very much about that.
Earl, there's sort of a history to historic sites here in Maine, isn't there? What were the first, second, third historic sites to be historic sites in Maine, and when did they get recognized?
Well, actually, our interest in historic sites in Maine goes right back to the early 19th century. One of the first interests in trying to preserve a building was here in Portland. In 1824, The decision had been made to replace the old First Parish Meeting House, where the First Parish Church is now on Congress Street. And a young man named Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who was going to Bowdoin.
Boy, that name sounds familiar.
He wrote a poem published in the newspaper decrying the fact that the old 1740 pre-revolutionary meeting house was going to be torn down because it was a historic building. Well, of course, it was torn down and it was replaced by a building that we now consider a very historic building. And all through the 19th century, there were attempts to save some of the key historic buildings, but it didn't really happen until after the Civil War when Maine became a major tourist destination. And one of the tourist experiences in the summer was to go to these historic places in Maine. So in 1900, it was the very first building opened as a historic museum, the old York Jail, which is still there, built about 1720.
It's fascinating.
It's a great place. And then the next year, 1901, interestingly, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's house, the Wadsworth Longfellow House, was left to the Maine Historical Society by his sister Anne and was opened that summer, 1901, as the first historic house museum in Maine. And from there on in, we've had so many historic houses and museums open in Maine all over the state for people to enjoy.
Well, and it's interesting you say that because those two kind of represent two kinds of places one's going to visit. One is the home of a famous person.
Yes.
And the other is something that represents the way it used to be but is not anymore.
Exactly. And also, with the old York Jail, at the very beginning, the idea was we save the building by making it into a local museum of local history, objects, and artifacts. And that, to some degree, is still true, but also now we're interpreting what went on in that building as well.
I want to ask you, Ellen, about this idea of an historic home where somebody famous lived, because you used to be director of the Henry Knox Museum, which is the house, but it isn't the house. So tell us about that. Anybody who's driven up Route 1 on the Midcoast has seen it.
It is definitely a landmark. And it's interesting, Earl, talking about the history of preservation in Maine and historic sites in Maine. The Knox Museum happened because the original house was taken down just before preservation really got going. The local people in Thomaston fought and tried to save the house. They went to the state legislature many, many times, but they said, why should we pay money for someone who's really from Massachusetts? And the house was eventually taken down in 1871 to make way for the railroad. But as preservation really started to build steam in the state of Maine, there was a group of very, very dedicated, very energetic DAR women in the Thomaston area who raised the money and created the plans to rebuild the house, reconstruct it. And they managed to catch the attention of Cyrus H.K. Curtis, the publisher. And he provided most of the money. And the original site, since it was underneath a railroad now, couldn't be used. And he insisted that they find this prominent spot in town, which they did. It's up on a hill, not down near the water where it used to be. But anyone driving up Route 1 has seen it and knows exactly where it is.
So what does one learn? What does one get from visiting the house that wasn't his house but is a replica in a different place? I mean, you're not absorbing Henry Knox's molecules by walking through it.
Well, that depends. Supposedly there is the ghost of one of his daughters that's attached to the furniture.
Okay.
I won't tell you who told me that, but
okay.
Supposedly there is a ghost there still. But you're learning about Henry Knox, and you're learning a bit about the preservation movement, too. At this point, the mansion, the replica, the reconstruction, has been standing for longer than the original mansion did and has become a symbol of colonial revivalism. It is historic in its own right at this point as a movement, the history of a movement in Maine.
All right. Yeah. Go ahead.
In a sense, Montpelier is kind of Maine's answer to Williamsburg, where many of the buildings were recreated in the same period in the 1920s and 30s. And the other great thing about Montpelier is that it is the setting for many original late 18th, early 19th century furnishings that belonged to General Knox, because although the house was torn down, the local inhabitants preserved many of the things that were there, and then they've gradually made their way back into the museum.
I want to get back to this idea, Bernard, that Ellen brought up about who pays. You know, it sounds like it was controversial back then, and it still remains a little sticky today, doesn't it? I mean, how do we determine when the state government, the federal government, ought to pay for preservation? When is it a local group, and that's just fine and just right?
It is a complex question to answer. There are certainly figures of importance that local, state, and national governments preserve the sites of that have those connections. But a vast number of historic sites have been preserved by individual personal actions, communities getting together. And we shouldn't discount the fact that the preservation of a historic site or place can be a kind of binder, a glue, to help keep a community together and give it direction. But we shouldn't forget perhaps the first national effort to preserve a historic site successfully, which was Mount Vernon, Washington's house, which was saved only because the Mount Vernon Ladies Association, starting in the 1850s, got together to save that house. Even though it was Washington's, it was required that women, private women, undertake that. And efforts to save other structures like the John Hancock House in Boston failed even with the reputation of Hancock, because there simply wasn't enough of a community effort to do that, although many people recognize that. So I think the whole historic preservation movement is largely a grassroots kind of effort on the part of individual people that recognize the importance of these places emotionally and historically into their own communities, and often stuck with them for years and years before success or occasionally failure occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that we all as individuals can often have a chance to support even today.
Earl, of the historic sites in Maine, and you mentioned there are so many, which are owned by the state, and how did those come to be owned by the state?
Yes. Well, the core of what the state owns are the forts. And it's a very interesting story, because actually the first state-owned historic site was down at Pemaquid. And there was a great deal of interest in the late 19th, early 20th century in saving the site of colonial Pemaquid that went back to the 17th century. And around 1902, the family that owned that site donated it to the state. There was a special commission, which included Joshua Chamberlain on it, to look into whether or not this was a worthy site to be acquired by the state. This was the first time the state was going to take this kind of step. And they agreed, they reported back to the governor that, yes, we should take this offer of Pemaquid. And then around 1909, there was a replica built of Fort William Henry, which was a 1692 fort at that site, which had been destroyed in the 18th century. That was our first step as a state into having a historic site. And then in the 1920s, after World War I, there were many surplus forts all over the country. The technology of war had changed, and many of the old Civil War-type forts were no longer viable for defense. The Secretary of War at that time got in touch with Governor Percival P. Baxter and said, "We have this list of forts, like Fort Knox, for example, at the mouth of the Penobscot River in Prospect, across from Bucksport. That's just one example. And we would like to have you consider buying these." And so Baxter, who had a wonderful historical background, I mean, we think of him mainly as a great conservationist, and indeed he was, saving Mount Katahdin and the 200,000 acres around it. But he also grew up in a household where his father, James B. Baxter, was a great historian and was for 30 years the president of the Maine Historical Society. So when this offer of these historic forts came along in the early 1920s, Baxter jumped at them, and he got the state to appropriate very modest amounts. These forts cost anywhere from about $500 to $2,000 apiece.
Imagine.
They were surplus property, and he acquired them and then quickly started their development as places for the public. And so they're the core of not only our historic sites in Maine, but also in many cases they're connected with our parks as well.
Mm. Ellen, are there places not worth saving? old places that were significant in their day, but really...
As much as it pains me to say, yes, there are places that every day that choices are made not to save them. You can't save everything. We have to be very responsible about looking at sustaining something. A really good example of that, actually, is the Maine State Prison. When it was in Thomaston, it was originally built in 1824. I believe it burned in 1924, Earl, and was reconstructed.
Yes.
And when the state decided to build the new facility in Warren, there was this looming question of there has been this state prison in Thomaston since 1824, and wow, maybe we should do something with this. But I think it probably would have been a mistake to try to save the old prison. It was a huge building. It was very... The state, in its wisdom, actually opened it up to give tours just before they tore it down in 2002. And I remember walking through the building and just being impressed with how dreary and how awful and how I would never want to end up in there. And I absolutely came away with the feeling of what kind of resources would it take to rehabilitate this building so that it could actually be used for apartments or office space or turned into a museum. It was just huge. So ultimately, I don't think it was a bad decision for the state to just let that go and for no one to try to do anything with it. And there's a beautiful green space there now in Thomaston. The original cemetery for the prison is still there. So there's remnants. You can get a sense of things. But
oh, boy. And I want to talk about cemeteries. But we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll take your calls and questions. And we'll talk about cemeteries. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communications systems. NorrisInc.com. And Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at MaineCF.org.
NASA is about to launch a new spacecraft to probe the sun. The mission is named after 91-year-old Eugene Parker, who will be there to see it blast off.
It's my first rocket launch, so it'll be very interesting.
Also, as fires burn through the West, there's a fight over whether utilities should have to pay when their equipment kicks off the fire. Those stories this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon, 4 to 6:30, here on Maine Public Radio.
My first car was a clunky Oldsmobile station wagon, and it was bright turquoise. I'm Noelle King, host of Morning Edition. I lived in a small town in a rural town, and so the only way to get from point A to point B was to drive. And I remember I would cut class, and I would just take the car all around. It felt like freedom. It was great. Turn your car into the programs you love. Here's how.
Visit mainpublic.org and click on Support.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are learning about Maine's historic sites, and we invite you to go onto our Facebook page and post which your favorite is and why. Joining me today, Ellen Dyer, who's a museum consultant and former director of the Knox Museum. Earl Shuttleworth is state historian and former director of the Maine Historic Preservation Commission. And Bernard Fishman is the museum director of the Maine State Museum. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining me on the line now is Tilly Lasky. She is outreach curator with the Maine Historical Society. Thanks for calling in, Tilly.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jennifer.
What is the role that the Maine Historical Society plays in Maine? It's both a place to visit and a resource, right?
Right. So we've got our museum and our historic site of the Wadsworth Longfellow House, as well as the Brown Research Library here on our campus in Portland. But we also host and facilitate Maine Memory Network, which is a statewide reach database. And so what it is, Maine Memory is a consortium of about 270 partners, and they have uploaded over the last 17 years right around 50,000 objects and 300 exhibits online. So that's 17 years of historical data that's available for people to take a look at.
And it's searchable, right? If you're interested in a specific thing, a specific person or moment in time or event in history, you can search that and see what's online, right?
Exactly. So we've done some really good keywords and Library of Congress headings so that people can do searches and find a broad swath of items relating to what they're looking for. Or you could search by a town and you could find individual records relating to that town or exhibits relating to that town. And also contact information for those 270 partners. So there might be a small historical society that doesn't have a website somewhere, you know, in Western Maine, but their information would be held on Maine Memory. So it's a really great jumping off resource for people who want to do front-end research before they head out on a trip to, you know, map out different areas that they want to visit.
So that's Maine Memory Net. Now, before I let you go, Tilly, I'm going to put you on the spot, as I am. I'm warning you, the guest in the studio. If you have a recommendation for an historic site to visit other than the Longfellow House.
Oh, sure.
A personal favorite.
You know, there are so, well, you know, Maine has the second highest rate of museums per capita in the United States. So you're going to find a historic site or historic house or something, you know, in every town that you visit. But I really want to do a call out to encourage people to go visit places like the Penobscot Nation Museum on Indian Island and the Passamaquoddy Cultural and Heritage Museums that are in Indian Township and Pleasant Point. And the Abbey Museum, of course, in Bar Harbor has a great collection relating to Wabanaki people. So those are places that are close to my heart, and also a few of them that I need to revisit. They've just redone their exhibits.
Well, Tilly, thanks so much for calling in. That's Tilly Lasky, Outreach Curator with the Maine Historical Society. Before the break, I promised we would talk about cemeteries. So very briefly, because I want to get to the other calls. I was in Western Maine yesterday out by Grafton Notch, and it struck me that I was in the middle of nowhere. And there was, I mean, as far as there were no buildings around or anything like that, and there was a cemetery. And I'm wondering a couple things. How do you all view cemeteries? And what are you looking for? I'm always struck by the number of children's gravestones, for example, or deaths that are in the same year. Either that or just struck by some of the beauty of the carvings on the headstones. But when you come across a cemetery that's not seemingly surrounded by homes or businesses, what are you thinking, Earl?
Well, it's because the whole landscape, the whole topography has changed. In the period from the Revolution up to the Civil War, there was this great expansion in rural Maine. Many, many small communities developed, and many of those were agricultural communities, particularly in inland Maine. And as a result, there were large numbers of farmsteads in open area because, of course, a lot of the topography was cleared for cultivation, for agriculture. And as a result, there were many private cemeteries. Either they were one family or they were a group cemetery for a small neighborhood. Those are the elements that have survived from that living pattern, whereas everything else is gone. The areas have gone into second or third growth. Some of the houses are gone and so on. But the cemetery remains to remind us of what life was like about 150 years ago in that part of Maine.
Yeah.
For me and in Maine, cemeteries have an especially romantic feel. I spent all of my childhood summers in Maine, basically, and went to summer camps here. And there was a summer camp called Winnico in the Bridgeton area, now closed, which had a small cemetery right behind the flagstaff. So every morning we would assemble as children around this flagstaff and recite the allegiance and salute the flag. And there was this little cemetery there that was always a draw and an interest. And of course, it had to be filled with ghosts, and none of us as children wanted to get near it. But it was a way of connecting us immediately with the sense that there was something older and deeper beyond us. And also in that camp on the edge, there was an abandoned farmhouse that gave me, as a child, one of my first historical experiences. And I was able to realize eventually that not very far away was the cemetery in which the actual people who had occupied this house were now buried. And again, it gave me that wonderful opportunity in a quiet atmosphere, only a few cars, no hurly-burly or circus-like enthusiasm around a historic site, of the discovery of history on my own in a way that allowed me to contemplate all of the feelings that a person has when looking at a cemetery and the stones and thinking naturally about what their lives were like and what would you say to them if you were to meet them today. So I have very fond memories of Maine cemeteries.
Alan, do you want to join in?
Oh, I would love to join in. This is one of my favorite subjects. Do you have 3 hours?
I don't.
Okay. I love poking around old cemeteries. There's a beautiful one in Sheepscut where you just get this feeling. You're looking over the river. It's on the old King's Highway. It feels very much like it used to. You don't see many modern trappings around you. And one of my favorites, actually, is the Old Settler Cemetery in Warren, which is just off of Route 1. You have to go down this dirt road and way back into the woods, kind of a reflection of the changing settlement patterns that Earl was talking about. And it has the most incredible skull and crossbones and the winged skulls. The poems, "Stop here, my friend, as you pass by, as you are now, so once was I, as I am now, so you must be, prepare for death and follow me." The thought process behind putting those kind of sentiments on stone to commemorate a person just is so vastly different from how we treat death today that it just is a very interesting window into people's mindsets at that point.
We'll go to Steve, who's calling from Scarborough. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hey, Jen. What a great topic. I just wanted to plug an old neighborhood of mine called the Connellborough Courthouse. It's a little bit west of Dresden, sort of between Dresden and Richmond off of 197. And it's just a wonderful example of early colonial architecture, fully maintained with furniture. And in the barn there is one of the best models of ice harvesting and that whole operation that I've ever seen.
Wow, so the Connellborough Courthouse. Thanks, Steve, for the recommendation. Is this a place you all are familiar with, Earl?
Oh, very much so, yes. The Connellborough Courthouse is an extraordinary building. It's three stories, which for 1761, when it was built in Maine, had to be a pretty large building. It was created by the Kennebec proprietors who were developing the Kennebec River before the Revolution, bringing settlers up. And the idea was to create some stability to the area with both forts and with laws. And so the Connellborough Courthouse was there as the original courthouse for Lincoln County, which was created in 1760. It's owned by the Lincoln County Historical Association. They open it every summer, and it's a very special place.
Great. Well, thank you, Steve, for the recommendation. Julia on Facebook writes, "My favorite historical fort since childhood is Fort Edgecombe on Davis Island in Edgecombe. It's an octagonal wooden blockhouse built about 1808, a structure to capture the imagination of any child."
Yes, and there again, in regard to that fort, that actually was a fort that people in the area of Edgecombe and Wiscasset started trying to preserve just after the Civil War. It ultimately entered the state ownership in the 1920s, but people started trying to save that as early as the 1870s.
We'll go to Mark, who's calling from industry. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to kind of give a shout out to the Norlands Museum in Livermore. Many people go there when they're children on, you know, school field trips. And I would encourage them to go back in their later years and have a tour of the mansion itself, which is the school kids don't get. You know, one of my favorite rooms in the whole world is the French Chamber. It has 37 different colors and gold leaf and gilding powders and bronzing powders on the ceiling. And it's just a magnificent, magnificent home. And the restoration that went into that is amazing. It was done by Tony Castro and company, and Tony's just an amazing restoration artist. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the house. I mean, everybody knows about the chapel and the library and the barn, but very few people get to tour the mansion itself.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, New Orleans is really an enchanting place. And as our caller mentioned, there are four major buildings there. There's a church, there's a schoolhouse, there's a library, a family library, and then there's the house. Israel Washburn Sr. Settled on that site around 1810, and he and his wife had 10 children, seven boys and three girls. The house, the original house from around 1810, was burned around 1843 and then replaced by another house that then burned in the 1860s. So the present house dates from 1868, and it's a very elaborate Victorian mansion in the Italian style. By that time, several of the sons had reached great prominence, both politically, militarily, economically, and so they helped their aged father to rebuild the house in the fashion of the day. And it's really a treat to go there.
Mark, thanks for calling in. Bernard, I want to go back to the conversation just a minute ago about Fort Edgecombe. I think you wanted to jump in, and I didn't see you until it was too late.
I did, thank you. It wasn't about the fort per se, but one of your callers mentioned the word imagination in connection with the childhood exploration of forts. And I just wanted to comment on that and say that for all of you listening, going to these historic sites is an opportunity to exercise your imaginations, because that's one of the most valuable and exciting things, I think, that can come out of historical exploration. We don't learn as much about history as we used to, and we don't carry with us as much knowledge. But to learn about something and to imagine how the house or the fort was used at a certain time can be a very stimulating experience that can lead you to other historical doors. And I just want to commend the visit to a historic site as a family and a personal opportunity to learn and to exercise that imagination, which can be so valuable in so many ways.
And right now in the summertime is a great time to go, correct? Because many are only open in the summer. So we're going to go to Jason on Facebook, who writes, "Shell middens on the Damariscotta River. It is but a scratch into what we know about those that lived on this island for thousands of years. That we lost so much of this history is tragic. History did not start when Europeans arrived." And Ellen, Jason makes a wonderful point, but what I also wanted to talk about is something doesn't have to be a building to be a historic site, does it?
It does not. If you know where to look, history is all around you. And the Shell Middens, even though it is technically a formal historic site and there are signs and a parking lot to look in there, it's one of those things that is just right outside your door or just off the highway. If you know where to look, there are those kinds of things. And not to talk about Henry Knox again, but I will. In Warren, there is actually the remains of a lock and canal system that he developed to bring wood down the St. George River to get it eventually down to Boston. And if you go back into the woods behind Payson Park and follow this little trail, you can see the dig out where the canal used to be. And there's a few other remnant stone walls, that kind of thing. And there's nothing else around there. It's all woods. And it's like discovering the past.
And there are also, there are historic vistas and there are historic boats. I mean, we're talking about buildings on land, but one can take a sailing trip and a piece of history in Maine.
Yes, I think, Earl, you, I'm sure, know the details about this, but I think there are at least two boats that are National Historic Landmarks in Maine. I think perhaps one is run by the Maritime Museum, but that is certainly true, and landscapes as well, and vistas, and town main streets. So I think when we think of historic places, we should look in our own places, in our towns, to go down the main street of a town like Gardner or Hollowell or beautiful places like Belfast, is to step back into the past to some degree and to think and have the opportunity to think about some of these stimulations and imaginary, with the use of the imagination that I've mentioned, and are part of the main historical experience that we not only who live here appreciate, but tens of millions of tourists appreciate as well. Another reason to think very kindly of the history of Maine historic sites and the need to preserve many of them.
All right. Well, we do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your calls and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Ollie's Trolley, offering narrated daily sunset Cadillac Mountain tours in August. Tickets and more information at ollie'strolley.com. And InSource Renewables, committed to providing renewable energy solutions that support Maine's communities, workers, and the planet. InSourceRenewables.com. And the Alzheimer's Association's Walk to End Alzheimer's, with 7 locations from York Beach to Fort Kent. Details at alz.org/walk.
Coming up on Speaking in Maine, our next program from the 2018 Champlain Institute.
We are carrying out the need that the president declares needs to happen around the world without a declaration of war and the budgetary background for that.
College of the Atlantic hosts former Navy Admiral Jonathan Greenert. Drawing on 40 years of experience, he'll discuss national security issues across the world in the 21st century. That's on the next Speaking in Maine, Thursday afternoon at 2 on Maine Public Radio.
Just imagine, it's been a week since our Super Thursday campaign, and we might still be here if it were not for many of you responding quickly last week. Today would be day 8. We suspect you have appreciated the uninterrupted programming during this last week. So again, thank you for being a contributor, helping to move last week's campaign along quickly. And double thanks if you became a new supporter. Public Radio works because of your support. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Historic Sites in Maine. Joining me in the studio, Ellen Dyer, who is an independent museum consultant, Bernard Fishman with the Maine State Museum, and Earl Shuttleworth, who's state historian. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-399-3566. Norma on Facebook writes, Troy Union Church is being restored. For the last 8 years, we've been working on this 1840 Troy Union Meeting House in Troy, Maine. It has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places since November 18, 2011. Original problem was a leaning belfry tower. The second cord was severely rotten and had to be replaced, or we would use the battle with time. And there's a lot of cases where there's a battle with time, isn't there, Earl?
Indeed.
Aren't there?
Well, I would just mention I'm familiar with the Troy Church, and it's a wonderful example of how people within a community can group together and preserve a local landmark, which is a very much a character-defining feature of their particular community. And old churches and schoolhouses are prevalent all through Maine, particularly through rural Maine communities, and they are key landmarks to define those communities.
Judy on Facebook writes, the Mary E. is the ship that was recently renovated and recommissioned at the Maine Maritime Museum. We're going to go to Dave, who's calling from Camden. There we go. My clicker just clicked you, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. This is Dave Jackson. I'm the director of the parks at the Camden Public Library. And I wanted to mention our wonderful amphitheater designed in 1928 by Fletcher Steele. It was designated a National Historic Landmark in 2013. Earl is familiar with the property, and it's a pretty big deal to be a National Historic Landmark. There are only about 2,500 of them in the whole country, and by the way, my partner Amy Rollins and I give historic walking tours every Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock.
Ooh, thank you, Dave, for calling in. I appreciate it. An email from Elliot. A must-see for Maine residents and Maine vacationers alike is the Maine State Building, one of only 5 buildings still in existence from the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. It is the only state building still standing. It was built with pride by Maine citizens. 9 quarries contributed to the first floor exterior, and its roof is Monson slate. The architect was Charles Sumner Frost from Lewiston. It was brought back to Maine by 3 Ricker brothers in 16 railroad cars at a personal expense of $30,000. It took 1.5 years to rebuild, though it has sat at Poland Spring Resort since 1895. Without heat through 90% of those winters, the maple floors are still tight. Maine pride and craftsmanship, a true treasure of Maine. I love that you wrote this in, Elliot, because I didn't know about the Maine State Building.
Yes. No, it's a remarkable structure. It's octagonal. It's in the Queen Anne style. It's almost like a sort of a small fantasy castle. And it has a beautiful interior. It was a case where many of the Maine industries at the time donated materials toward the creation of this building for the World's Fair in Chicago.
We'll go to John calling from Cumberland. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hello, good morning, good afternoon. I just first of all want to thank you all for your service and sparking an incredible interest of history in our state, especially Earl. You've done a fantastic job. My question and discussion would be about Native American history and historic Native American sites around the state of Maine, which are absolutely fascinating to me and many others. And also, on a different subject or a different track, so to speak, railroad history. Our state is very colorful with standard gauge and narrow gauge railroad right of ways all over the state. So thank you very much, everybody, for taking my call.
Thank you, John. Do you all have recommendations? We know an early caller did as well for sites to visit as far as Native American history. Tilly Lasky mentioned 3. Do you have any to add to that, Bernard?
Well, I'll mention one because it also represents part of the discovery of history that I like personally, which is the site of the Norridgewock Village and the monument to Father Sebastian Rail, who was a priest working with the Norridgewock Indians and was killed with most of them in a raid in 1724 by the English. And the monument stands in Madison, I think technically is where it is, in the middle of the cemetery. And as we've talked about cemeteries are often very relaxing, contemplative places and not necessarily tragic ones. But this one is a mix, and the monument is there, and it says something very distinctive about Native American history, as well as the colonial conflicts between France and England over Maine's territory. And for me personally, to learn about that site and then to try to find it, which was very difficult and took about an hour of driving here and there and asking local people. And then there I was at this fascinating place where a whole village had been destroyed and there was no one there. And I was left with my own thoughts and the great weight and the great excitement of history to comfort me. I just think that was a wonderful excursion personally, and recommend in a more general way that people try to explore history. Many of the comments we've had today are on that theme. You don't always have to go to some restored, beautiful, well-traveled, expensive site to experience the thrill of historical discovery, and Maine itself offers many such places.
Thank you, John, for your call. Let's go to Robert calling from Buxton. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. It's Bob Caridi. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing good. I am calling just to say how grateful I am to have spent a career working on these great buildings in the state of Maine. And people should visit all of them if they have a chance. But we currently have parts to the Victoria Mansion in our shop right now and have taken all of these buildings apart and put them back together and just enjoyed the process very much. We're hoping there'll be a new raft of younger people coming up that can do this work. And I want to say something about possibly educating people to learn this craft. There's quite a few of us in the state, but we're getting old and retiring. And hopefully there'll be some point where we can work some type of education for preservation into our schools. So... anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob Caridi, for calling. Thoughts?
Well, of course, Bob points out the Victoria Mansion, and this is a very exciting site to go to. Built between 1858 and 1860, it's in downtown Portland, and it's considered the finest, most intact Italianate mansion in the country prior to the Civil War. It only was owned by two families, and it has its original interiors and its original furnishings. It's very special to see.
Thanks, Bob, for calling. We have an email from Leith. My favorite historic site is the Monhegan Lighthouse. 20 years ago, it was preserved by Monhegan Museum, which incorporated it into the existing historical and cultural museum. It also, of course, has a fabulous art collection and gallery. So thank you for that tip. Brian on Facebook says, I would like to do a shout out for the Main Island. So along the same theme, we'll go to Jack, who's calling from Camden. Hi, Jack. Go ahead.
How are you?
Good.
You have a wonderful group of callers. And as a child, I used to come up from New Jersey every summer and go to Fort Edgecombe. And it was magic. At that time, they had a lobster pound there owned by the Bordway family. And it was absolutely magical. But what I wanted to talk about is a little oblique. I've had an idea I've thrown out to people. Nobody's picked it up yet. And I think it's a pretty interesting idea nationally. But the Maine Historical Society could try doing this. They could link the GPS coordinates of a graveyard. And this is something very, very down the dirt road that nobody would ever think to visit. And then as soon as you tag those coordinates, a historical description of the people that were buried there, their lives, everything would come on, and it would be on your phone, which is ubiquitous. So you could visit these very, very off-road kinds of places and find out more about the history of the place. And it would be relatively simple to do. And I think it would be a wonderful thing for the Historical Society to start thinking about that, because I think it could, just by its novelty, increase traffic for them.
Well, thanks, Jack. It is a good idea. And Bernard, there's so many more opportunities generally with the advent of the technology, your fingertips. We had someone from Historical Society talk before about the Maine Memory Network, which really takes advantage of the power of the internet. But now with, you know, I'm sure there are all sorts of creative things, geotagging and things like that going on.
Well, there are certainly many opportunities technologically to experience more about history, and that's becoming more and more significant and necessary. But I'll continue to say that seeing the actual sites themselves and the historic sites is the best of all, and that there is really no substitute for that. It's a communal activity and a personal activity. And I want to put in a plug for history as a profession and to encourage younger people to think of it. We have fewer and fewer people becoming interested in the humanities in general and the kinds of things that have led the three of us sitting here to become workers, toilers in the field of history. We have a number of interns at the Maine State Museum who've been very stimulating to the museum, and I hope the museum has been stimulating to them. And we welcome that, and we encourage people not only to take an interest in history, but help your children think about it, help them think about getting in careers related to preservation and elsewhere, because we need it. It's wonderful, noble work, and benefits many, many people.
And in response to the technology, there has been some work moving along the direction that the caller suggested, not in cemeteries per se, but the Cultural Emergency Resource Coalition, which was formed by the Maine State Museum, in 2013, and is a collaboration of several different state cultural agencies, developed a GIS map of over 1,100 cultural institutions around the state, museums, libraries, historical societies, historic sites. And you can go on the CIRC Maine website and actually go in and take a look. So if you want to try to find some place that's kind of out in the middle of nowhere, the Ambejijis Boomhouse Museum comes to mind, which is only accessible by boat. You can get on the map and just kind of take a look.
What's How does one find that map?
It's on the CIRC Maine website, which is cercmaine.org. And there's a link right there for the CERC map.
Okay, great. Thanks, Jack, for your call. I'm going to try to squeeze in one more call. Mark in Portland, can you go quickly, please?
Yes, I want to know if your presenters have ever heard of the old Crockett House in Raymond on the far southeastern corner of Sebago Lake. That when I lived there, I was told it was one of the first land grants after the Revolution. And Eagle's Nest Lodge on a hill from the top of which you can see the Portland skyline in gray, which during Prohibition was a speakeasy.
Ah, well, Mark, thanks. Anybody here familiar with those buildings? No? No. Okay. Well, Mark, I think you've stumped our experts, and that is incredible considering who our experts are. Thank you so much for calling in. We just have a little bit of time left, and I want to go back to one of the commenters who said they wanted to shout out to Maine Islands. And Earl, I know that's sort of just a way of saying Maine itself.
Yes, I think there's a real concept here that certainly is reflected in our conversation today about the fact that Maine itself is the museum. And I think Bernard has said, you know, this sense of exploration in discovering history for yourself personally. And there are so many opportunities in the state in traveling through all parts of the state to rediscover that history. And I think that's kind of what we've been focusing on this afternoon.
All right. And Ellen, you mentioned the CERC Maine website. Where's another website, Bernard, that you would recommend if someone just wants? Does the Maine State Museum have a map?
Yes. And we recently completed a very significant digitization and public access project with the Maine Historic Preservation Commission to record and make available 22,000 mainly 19th century photographs from the MHPC collections. Many of them of historic sites and buildings. They can be accessed through websites at MHPC and the Maine State Museum. And that's only the smallest opening and beginning of what you can discover if you really approach the web with history in mind.
All right. A way to lose a lot of hours.
In great fun. History is fun. I want people to realize that.
Oh, I think we've established that this hour. Thank you all for being here. That was Bernard Fishman. He's the museum director of the Maine State Museum. Also here, Earl Shuttleworth, state historian and former director of the Maine Historic Preservation Commission, and Ellen Dyer, a museum consultant and former director of the Knox Museum. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as links and resources at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.